This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Danger! Danger!
It's not a lineup, it's not an army, it's not a stable, and it's not a family. It's an alliance of businessmen.
Take it right.
Place to Be Nation, you're listening to the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast, featuring a different way to look at and debate the history of wrestling. And now, your co-host, the PTBN PWO two-man power trip, JT and Will.
The Dangerous Alliance would rather die than surrender to you.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode 7 of the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, JT, and joining me, as always, my other half of the two-man power trip here at Place to Be Nation and Pro Wrestling Only, and that is good old Will from Texas. Will, how you doing?
Man, I am doing good. I'm having a great week, and I am looking forward to the show.
And it's a big week because we're heading into a big weekend. We'll talk about that in a moment. Let me first bring in our producer with us, as always, Mr. Dan McGinn. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm great, guys. I can't get enough of hearing your voices. I feel like it was only yesterday we were doing this again for episode 6, and here we are today.
I'll say the weeks fly by when you're having fun like we have here on these sites.
Absolutely.
So, a lot going on at PlaceMation.com and Pro Wrestling Only this week, because it is SummerSlam week. We have, as you would have seen, a week full of Goodwill Wrestling's SummerSlam podcast, just like we had for WrestleMania. Those are ongoing. A lot of SummerSlam-themed pieces on PlaceMation.com. Main event special edition this week, looking at SummerSlam. And, of course, next week we'll have reaction shows, everything going on. And a group of us, of course, at Place of Nation, will be in Brooklyn for the weekend, both at Ring of Honor and SummerSlam. So we'll be talking all about that over the next couple weeks. But tonight we are here for another edition of the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. We have three challenges ahead of us. One, I think I heard, Dan in his production meeting with Basil talking things over that it may be SummerSlam related, Will. We'll see. I don't know, because of course he just pulls these out of a hat and surprises us. So
of course he does.
So with that said, why don't we go ahead and turn it over to Dan to tell us what the first challenge is.
Well, guys, it's like being in first grade all over again. We're going to play a little game called Fill in the Blank.
All right, and this is a good game, Dan, so we need you to stick around here. And this is a really fun one. I'm excited for this one. So we're going to have a bunch of different categories, and Dan is going to have a list of wrestlers, and Will and I need to debate the choices to fill in the blank. So, for an example, fill in the blank, XXX was Randy Orton's greatest opponent. And Will and I will debate who we think was Randy Orton's greatest opponent. And then on and on and on. So we have a list of guys. We have a bunch of different categories. We'll be filling in the blank. And Will and I will both come up with answers. We'll argue who we think it should be. And then we will move on from there. So, Dan, what is our first category?
Well, our first category is very much what you just said. We're talking best opponents. And I got a handful of guys to choose from. I'm going to start, though, with who many feel is one of the greatest of all time, if not the greatest of all time. Bruno Sammartino.
Okay, well, I'll let you go first here. So who was Bruno Sammartino's greatest opponent?
This is a no-brainer, man. Larry Zbyszko.
Yeah. I can't think of a better one. I mean, Billy Graham, I've been watching some of his matches for our Place to Be Nation Network Adventure, and I've enjoyed those. I enjoyed the dynamic because you have kind of the staunch, old-school, beloved face versus this new, brash asshole heel in Billy Graham, but Zbyszko was definitely the most heated feud he ever had. The crowd's just out of their minds for it. So
yeah, well, it's a feud that we have the most footage of, so we're able to see it.
True. Yep.
Progress from the very beginning all the way to the Shea Stadium match. And I was thinking maybe like Ivan Koloff, from the early 70s. We just don't have the footage, man. And
right.
Ivan was a great wrestler, and so I really wish we had that footage. But Larry Zbyszko was just a great heel. He kind of looked like you're like a northeastern babyface of the time,
mm-hmm. Out of shape,
out of shape. Yeah. But he made a better heel. And throughout his career, he was an awesome heel.
It's funny because we just rewatched his debut match for one of the previous installments of the Network Adventure. It's a MSG show from 77. And he, it was his debut in MSG, so that was cool to see. And then, of course, in there, and they mentioned in that match how he's a friend and protege of Bruno. So they were laying the seeds really early on that one.
Yeah. That was the thing back then, though, right? That they could let a storyline simmer for 2 years, you know, because WWF was not very big on storylines at the time. At least that's what the guys from Titans of Wrestling tell me.
Right, right. And that was the June 27th, 77 MSG show. It was Larry's MSG debut. But yeah, and they could let it simmer too because it just didn't have, I mean, they were on TV, but it was just, you know, we don't need to go into the reasons why it's different. But there were many reasons why they could draw feuds out like
that. It was a smoke-filled room. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So not 75 hours of TV. And of course, that was all led to the culmination with Larry Zbyszko's Hall of Fame speech, peeking through the bushes for 45 minutes talking about meeting Bruno.
All right, Dan, what's next?
From one of the greatest of all time to the one who called himself the Great One. How about The Rock?
Huh. The Rock's greatest opponent. I mean, all right, so a couple guys, you know, come to mind right away.
Yeah, I got one. And to me, this one isn't even anything to debate. Stone Cold.
Yeah. Well, it's debate, so let's go through a few, and we'll see if we come up with anyone else. I mean, you got Triple H, right?
Not even close.
Okay. Why not?
Well, because he only has the ladder match with him and the Iron Man match, I would say, right? But even then, I think the fact that, like, Triple H beat The Rock at WrestleMania when Rock was the face, it kind of lets the steam out. Oh, well, we'll let you win the match next month. The first heel to walk out with the belt, right, at WrestleMania.
Right, which was, just in retrospect, well, I don't know if they take it back, though, because Backlash ended up doing a monster number, which was their goal, because remember they teased Austin being in Rock's corner, and he came out to that awesome pop and did a really good rating, a really good buy rate for that show.
If you teased Austin with Rock having the belt, same thing happens.
Yeah, true. I agree. But I think they thought maybe Rock winning it there with Austin coming in. I'm just going through their thought process at the time. But they had the Mania four-way, but then they had the Backlash match and the Judgment Day match, which were very good. And then
I didn't like the interference with the – was that the Judgment Day?
Yeah.
Or was that Backlash? And then –
that was like a minute and a half out of 60 minutes. I mean, that's going to be your main critique.
But it's still a booking problem, whereas to me – like Rock versus Austin, like the three times they did it, I liked every single one.
So you like the finish at 17?
I see why they did it.
Okay, so I see why they did the other one. So
yeah, whereas like but even then, like Austin, even though he was trying to play heel, was the face in that arena, you know. So.
So remember last week,
a little weird doing face versus face, whereas 1999 it was clear face versus heel, and then 2003 it was a clear face versus face. So
remember our last episode, you told me you didn't like Bruiser Brody, and I was a little surprised, and we talked about it for a minute, right? It was Bruiser Brody when I was like, oh yeah, you didn't like him. So I'm going to tell you a little something that many of our listeners may know, but I don't know if you do. I cannot accept all the love for that WrestleMania 17 match, and I don't know what it is. I've watched it. I've tried. I admit it's a very, very good to great match. For some reason, I cannot get over the hump accepting it as like this five-star classic. And I don't know what it is. I don't know why. I have no idea why.
I'll meet you halfway, and I'll say that it is not a five-star match or close to five stars.
Okay, good.
Okay, because I'm kind of with you on that.
And it's not the finish. Like, I don't even mind the heel turn. It's not that. I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on it.
It's the style they were wrestling at the time. It's an inferior style, man.
Yeah, but I don't mind that style. Like, I've liked other matches with that style. But I think of that year alone, and I could think of, like, multiple matches in WWF alone, WWF, that I like better than, you know, that
one. Well, I'll give you an example since we're talking about The Rock. I like Rock versus Hogan better.
Yeah. Yeah, I may too, you know? And I like Austin versus Kurt Angle at SummerSlam much better.
I wouldn't even argue with that, you know? So yeah, I think that the the love is a little extreme, but it's also a very feel good show in the sense that that's widely considered one of the best WrestleManias of all time.
Right? Yeah, and I'll never argue that. I mean, to me, it's top two. This is another hill I've died on before, arguing that I think WrestleMania 19 is even with 17, but I don't get much traction.
I would have to go back and actually listen to what I said on the WrestleMania week shows. I don't even remember anymore which show I argued as the best, but
I mean, I wouldn't debate heavily that 17's not, but I think 19's closer in the conversation.
Okay, so an argument for April. Stone Cold, but there's two of them. Who else? Not Foley, right? Those matches just weren't that good.
No, I mean that was a good feud, like in the moment on TV. Like I wouldn't say he's his greatest opponent, but
Cena.
It did a lot. Yeah, Cena's a tricky one because I feel like they had a really good start to their feud, and the first match was awesome, and then it just went off a cliff from there.
Right. Yeah, so...
Farouk?
If you're going to ask me to choose between Stone Cold and Triple H, I'm going to choose Stone Cold every day. I'm not Scott. I can't watch I can't watch Triple H matches, much less like support him in anything.
So. No, and I'm going to go Austin, too, to see the three big Mania matches. But, you know, Shamrock, to me, is a sleeper. And I know I'm Shamrock Mark, but they had a really good feud in 97 to 98. They fought on multiple pay-per-views. I thought that was another one that really helped get Rock over the hump and be established. I think he's in the conversation, at least to be mentioned, I'll put it that way.
I don't mind him as an honorable mention, but yeah. I think The Rock and Kurt Angle had some really good matches together, you know?
All right, so here's a sleeper one, because their feud was a little bit short, but produced great matches with high stakes. And what about Rock and Jericho?
I like that. I like that matchup a lot. But
four strong matches from the fall to January.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I liked it a lot. At the time, I thought it was one of the greatest things ever. I still love that title change where Jericho wins the big gold belt.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd have to watch it over again. See, you and Scott, y'all have the advantage of having watched all these shows and talked about them with Kevin Kelly and everything. I just haven't watched a lot of that stuff since it happened.
That's a series worth revisiting. So they had four matches. They fought on at No Mercy. They fought at Raw, which many argue is the best of the four, the Raw match. They fought at Vengeance and then the Rumble. So those four matches
Vengeance was part of the tournament, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Where Jericho won the unified belt. And then they fought at Rumble.
Yep, Rumble was the last one.
That's considered kind of the least of the four, but right. It was still a really good match on that show. Yeah.
Right. That's like around a 4-star or like, you know, 3¾-4 to me.
Sure.
And then
sure.
Their best, you know, best work would be, I think Raw's, you know, universally credited as the best. No Mercy second, Vengeance 3.
Really?
Rumble 4.
I thought No Mercy was the title change. I always thought that was considered the best, but.
The Raw one,
like I said, I'd have to revisit the two matches, I guess.
The Raw one I need to rewatch. That's probably the one I've seen the least. And I think it's on a DVD. I think it's on the Action DVD or one of those DVDs as an extra. And that was so that's one I'd like to revisit to see how it stacks with the No Mercy. But I mean, I'm comfortable putting Jericho as a top three guy to feud with The Rock.
You know, once you said his name, that's not somebody where I would like really like. I didn't even question it. I think I'm with you on that one. I agree.
I'd probably go Austin, Triple H, and Jericho were his three best feuds. I would say.
I'd say Austin, Jericho, and Austin.
Austin 97. All right, Dan.
I'm going to give Triple H zero credit. Right?
I know. Like, I know. I'm hoping Dan says Triple H is one of these, but we'll see. Dan, who's number three?
For best opponent, why don't we go with the former Widowmaker, Barry Windham?
Widowmaker. All right, well, I'll let you start this one off.
Once again, this is an easy no contest. This is Ric Flair.
Yeah. You know, and that's the feud that really put Windham on the map in 87.
Yeah, and then they had a great match at the Crockett Cup.
Mm-hmm. It was the long TV match. Was it 45 minutes? What was the one that they went at? It was like the whole show. Was it worldwide?
Yeah, it was a worldwide match in early 87. And then they had, I want to say they had a great match at one of the Battle of the Belts from Florida in 86 as well. And so I think really, like I like Barry Windham a lot. I think he's a really good wrestler. I don't buy into the idea that, oh, if he would have just stayed in shape, he would have been one of the best ever. I think he really benefits from working with really great wrestlers.
Right.
Like, like I've argued on many shows in the past that Dustin Rhodes is one of the best tag team workers of all time, and Barry Windham was his tag partner, you know, or you know, he had great tag matches with I don't even think Mike Rotundo. I think that's why that, like, you don't see a lot of great Mike Rotundo and Barry Windham tag matches, because they just aren't that good as a tag team. The other guy I would mention, and he had a great match with him in the Watts UWF after Crockett bought it, and in WWF, is Dick Murdoch.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my two top ones, Ric Flair and Dick Murdoch for Barry Windham.
I'd go Flair. I mean, I'm trying to rattle through my mind like his second WCW run after the Widowmaker. And I can think of great matches and moments he had, you know, teaming with Dustin, feuding with the Dangerous Alliance, and, you know, different matches he had. But I can't think of, like, a feud that stands out. Like, he was just involved in that kind of mishmash feud.
Well, you know what ruined it? In 1988, do you remember when Barry turned heel and became a horseman?
Yes.
He turned on Lex Luger?
Yep, in the tag match, yep.
No, and rest in peace, Dusty Rhodes. But this was one of the biggest problems with Dusty Rhodes at the time, interjecting himself into the main event marquee feuds where he had no business going. So when Flair was feuding with Jimmy Garvin, Dusty Rhodes has to come out into the studio to defend Precious instead of Garvin standing up like a man.
Right.
You know? When Windham turns on Luger, okay, it's the Midnight Rider or Dusty Rhodes getting mad and, you know, feuding with Windham throughout the Great American Bash that year, when it should have been Luger versus Windham in a blood feud.
Right, right,
and
exactly.
That was like kind of like the danger of having your booker as one of your top stars, you know. I kind of like the Watts, you know, who refused to ever make Bill Dundee a top, even though I love Bill Dundee, make him a top star. Okay, you can book my territory, but you can't be a top star. You're gonna be a jobber in the mid card. Sorry, guy.
What do you think of Wyndham's match with Bam Bam Bigelow at Starrcade? It was 87, right, when they fought?
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
Yeah,
but I
too.
Know other people did not like it. So
I enjoyed that one. Yeah. It surprised me. I watched it probably for the first time a few years ago.
Like, you know, it's a little go spot fest stuff, but I thought it was super fun.
Which is cool when you look at the guys. You know what I mean? Like that's pretty neat that those two guys are having that type of match.
Yeah, no, I agree, but just not enough for, like, to compare to like the Flair or Murdoch feuds.
Oh, and it wasn't even a feud. I mean, I was just mentioning it since we're talking to Wyndham, but all right, sure. Let's go Flair. I can't really think.
Flair is by far number one, you know, but Murdoch is the only one who, like, I mean, I give Murdoch props because, like Flair, him and Wyndham had great matches in two different companies. So.
All right, Dan, who's next?
Do we have a different fill in the blank here, Dan?
Well, guys, I was going to say we're about halfway done with this first fall. Do you want a new category?
Yeah, let's mix it up a little bit.
Let's mix it
up. All right, guys. We're going to go with peak year.
Ooh, I like this one.
For a particular wrestler. And you mentioned this one just a moment ago. I was kind of curious. What is the peak year for Justin's favorite, Bam Bam Bigelow?
Oof. This is a good one. So, Will, let's define peak first before we do it. So do you want to talk about peak in-ring ability? Do you want to talk peak draw? Do you want to just talk peak, like, all around? Like, this was the year that you would bank on them.
See, Bam Bam's a hard one because I like Bam Bam. I like the character. I loved him as a kid. I thought he was a monster. I loved the tattoos and the flames and all that stuff, right? Here's the problem with Bam Bam. I've never thought that he was a great wrestler, because a lot of his matches really do leave you wanting a better match. And so if you talk about his peak wrestling match, it's pretty sad because his peak wrestling match came in 1986-87 against Jerry Lawler in Memphis when he was a rookie.
Right.
Okay. If you talk about draw, right, I mean, he was clearly the headliner of WrestleMania 11, right? What was that, 95?
Yeah, so that's the year I was going to pick. Was 94, like WrestleMania 10 to WrestleMania 11, and he was doing some pretty good work. He had that the fun match with Razor at King of the Ring. He had some solid stuff on TV. The team with IRS was better than it should have been. And then he starts getting, you know, pushed hard towards the end of the year really good match at the Rumble with him and Tatanka against Kid and Holly. That was a fun match. And then,
yeah, that was good. That
and
was
then
good.
The main event with LT, where, I mean, he's a WrestleMania main event star with a mainstream sports figure, which is, I mean, you have to consider that his peak as a draw anyway.
Except for the fact that the wrestling business was in the doldrums.
Sure.
You know? And so then you got to think about, like, the early 90s when he was in Japan.
Yep.
Kind of tearing it up, like the same time that the Steiners were tearing it up and Vader was tearing it up, and you know, so there's Bam Bam's an interesting case.
Well, so the other two spots I want to talk about, one was 93, where I think was maybe his best in-ring stuff outside of, you know, maybe that rookie year, but when he had all the matches with Brett were very good. But the problem with 93 is then he devolves into that feud with Doink at the end of the year.
Yeah. Well, and then the problem is, too, this is, like I said, this is my big criticism of Bam Bam. This really, honestly, my criticism of Bruiser Brody, too, is that the character and the look of the character is so much cooler than the actual wrestler.
Right.
You know what I mean? Bam Bam, I think, oh, man, that guy's a monster. Oh, God, are you kidding me? He does moonsaults and cartwheels, and then he gets in the ring and has average matches.
Well,
you
so
know?
That's why it's
so and we have a template for that type of guy. His name is Vader.
Right. Well, so let me throw this one out at you, because I think it's a year where that stuff didn't matter as much, and he was considered, you know, relative to the company, a draw, because he was pushed as a major star, a rebirth, one of their top, you know, heel guys, and that's ECW, his run from late 97 to late 98. That got him the gig in WCW, because he had such a strong presence, a strong year. The whole feud with Taz, slamming him through the ring, then through the ring walkway, was part of the triple threat with Candido and Shane Douglas. That was clearly, you know, the center point of ECW at times. You know, throwing Spike Dudley into the crowd, like just tons of memorable moments. Won the world heavyweight title, I should say, rather, and then. Was involved with the TV title that he had as well with the feud with Taz. So, I mean, I'm kind of to the point where I think you could argue his best run was that night, late 97 to late 98 in ECW.
Man, I watched a lot of that Bam Bam Bigelow stuff with my good buddy Dylan Hells and who else did we watch it with? I want to say Chris Zellner from Exile. And man, Bam Bam just didn't hold up. Like, you know,
that
we got
run.
To watch a lot of fan cams. We got to, you know, the TV was exciting stuff. And like for somebody who didn't experience ECW live, seeing that stuff on tape and going through the stage and all that, it's like, wow, you know, like really exciting stuff. But then when like you watch all the fan cams and like you realize how many nights this guy took off and. You know what I mean? It left me disappointed, but I can see why somebody wouldn't enjoy that, especially, you know, if you're a huge ECW guy who lived through that era. So
let me ask you this. This is where we'll land. So we're not talking about whether or not he was good, right? We're not talking about whether he was, or we just need to figure out his peak. So what was, regardless of if his peak was below what it should have been, if he was disappointing, what are we still considering his best year for what he did?
I think I'm going to go 95 and surrounding that whole LT thing simply because it is a WrestleMania main event. And you can never take that away from somebody.
And he did a good job with it. Like that's a pretty good match. So I'll go.
Unless you're Benoit and you erased it from history.
I'll go right after WrestleMania 10 till right after WrestleMania 11 with his initial. Oh, you know, I'll go King of the Ring to King of the Ring, because WrestleMania 10, he was still fighting Doink. So King of the Ring 94, to me, was kind of his rebirth, because he has a fun match with Razor at King of the Ring, dumps Luna, goes with DiBiase, and then up to King of the Ring 95, that little stretch, he's pretty much on par with Diesel as, like, the top face in the company until Shawn really got going. So,
yeah.
You know, and he was pretty over. We are rewatching 95 now for the Vintage Vault refreshes, and the crowd was into him. He had the fire coming out and everything. So for those first couple months after the LT match, They were into him. So I'll say that was probably his peak run, 94 to 95.
I have no problem with that whatsoever.
All right, so who is next, Dan?
Well, guys, 10 minutes to go, and Scott Criscolo has paid me handsomely for this, what's the peak year for Triple H?
When did he debut?
Well, overall, he debuted in WCW in, what, 94?
Okay, so his peak year was 93 when he wasn't in the business.
Come on.
That's easy. Done. No other year comes close.
All right. Well, I will say 2000 was clearly Triple H's peak. If you had to pick a year where he was having, well, how about this? I mean, you could justify it or choose it by saying what year was he least hated on the internet? To me, that was 2000, because he was actually kind of an underground favorite in 2000 on the internet. He was like,
yeah.
It wasn't crazy to mention him along with like the Radicals and those guys as like a favorite of the internet fans. I mean, he was up there with guys. You wanted to see him in these after the Cactus Jack matches, the Rock matches, Benoit, Angle, like all those feuds and matches, people were into him. And they were upset when he tore his quad in 2001. Like that, what people weren't happy with that. And then when he came back.
Well, you know what? I was on the internet at the time. It's mixed in this sense. Because even back then, it was apparent that the guy was playing games and holding people back. You know what I mean? Like the things he gets criticized about that were magnified, like in 2002, 2003, 2004, right, were starting to show themselves. And it really came about with the Kurt Angle feud, where he refused to put Angle over because right, who would believe that Stephanie would leave me for him? Well, so, I don't know, because he's a better-looking Olympic fucking gold medalist,
right?
You know,
so that was a big strike. But I feel like people were still like willing to forgive at that point. I feel like it's more retrospect.
Here's why I'm going to argue with you on this point, and it's a point my buddy Dylan Hills would not only argue, he would be profane, and he'd be collecting.
Oh, we know.
He'd be collecting a bunch of F's in our F jar right now. Here's the reality of that situation. The whole company was hot. You know what I mean? The Rock was at his peak of being considered great. Jericho had finally gotten it, you know, after a really rough start. I'm going to just say, you know, the Radicals, Benoit, and all those guys were putting hot matches on. Edge, Hardy, the Christians, the Dudleys, the entire company, not just Triple H, but the entire company was kind of hot that year, you know, as an entire entity. And so, but when I look at Triple H's matches match by match, I'm just not excited about them, you know. I like the Last Man Standing with Jericho. I did rewatch that one and I didn't like it. You know, I loved it when I first watched it, but man, it did not age well with me. I'm really down on Cactus Jack as a whole right now, so I'm kind of on a Foley exodus right now, or Foley vacation, you know.
Well, so my point on the Angle stuff at the end of 2000, when you look back, you realize how much they killed the momentum. But I feel like in the moment, WWF was so hot, you noticed the blip, but I feel like not everyone realized that the company was on the downswing until like after Mania 17. So I think in retrospect, you look back and you say, huh, it started there. But I think as it was happening, you were disappointed. But then Triple H the next month has a stiff match with Benoit that people loved. And then he's putting over Jericho and Benoit in that tag match on SmackDown. So it's like, you know, you're kind of like, oh, all right. And he has the match in No Way Out with Austin, Three Stages of Hell. So I feel like he had won back some of that. Like, all right, we get it. And then when you look back at his track record in later years, you could point it to there now.
Yeah.
But I feel like at the time, that wasn't like a huge – it was annoying, but it wasn't a huge black mark because he still rebounded and had some pretty good stuff afterwards. And
you,
then,
you know what? Well, let me counter with another year.
Okay.
And tell you why. Triple H has this character, right, that, you know, a lot of people on the net despise,
mm-hmm,
right? And – he turned a real life situation, the Daniel Bryan situation with the company, and basically trolled the entire I almost had an F in the F jar.
That was close enough.
I caught my sight. No, count that's it. Not an F. Don't count it, Dan. There was no CK at the end of that, Dan.
I'm going to edit it as such.
So I'm going to say 2013. Puts over Daniel Bryan in the best match of Triple H's life, turned a horrible situation kind of into this magical Mania moment, and then puts over the Shield a couple of months later.
All right, so you're saying like mid-13? So
yeah,
I think you got to put it after WrestleMania 29, you have to start it, because the match with Brock was brutal there. So I think you're going to start like mid-13 to mid-14 is what you want.
No, I just mean the specific 2 months with Brian and the Shield.
Well, it's peak year is the game, so you gotta go a year. So,
well, it all happened in 2013.
All right, so we'll go 13-14 and 2000.
Why are we talking triple?
I don't know. You went on the rant. It wasn't me. You went on for 15-minute filibuster on him.
Wait, you're the one who did 10 minutes on why 2000 was so great. That's
you went 10 minutes on why Kurt Angle should have banged Stephanie in October. All right, Dan, give us one more I think we have time for.
Have to be a lightning one here.
Well, you know, Will, I hate to break it to you, but you had already dropped an F-bomb prior to that happening.
Yes!
So,
no!
We're all evened up at one.
Finally, I've been waiting.
Yeah, just
I'll
mention
believe it when I hear it. I have to hear it.
I should have celebrated with a big F-bomb to go back and realize I fell back behind.
All right, guys. You got 3 minutes left. Another peak year for you. How about the guy who Triple H always wanted to be, the Ric Flair?
Oh, God. That's not an easy one. We got 3 minutes.
3 minutes with Ric Flair.
Give us another one, Dan. We'll save Flair for next time.
Would you prefer Dean Douglas?
Yeah, actually, yeah, that's easy.
All right, let's do that. That's much easier, yes.
That would probably be 1996, after he came back to ECW, after the Dean Douglas character. Shane Douglas was really good in 96, at least maybe it was 97. Oh, man. But like 96, 97. I think he was pretty good in ECW.
I mean, yeah, what's his next best run? The early WCW,
with
Steamboat stuff.
With Steamboat, yeah. I think that's about it for Douglas.
Yeah, but I think 96 is definitely the one because he came back all pissed off, and that's when he really started his. You know, he had the year in 94 where he threw the title down and all that, but 96 into 97 is when
like
he had the triple threat.
95, like or whatever part of 95, it was more angles and TV,
right?
Stuff, but the matches were no great shakes. But like having decent, solid main event matches was when he came back. That's when really kind of showed his mettle.
Right, and that's when he had the was that when he broke Pitbull's neck and all that too? That was a good feud.
Yeah, and then I think he had some really good matches with Sabu, Terry Funk, Too Cold Scorpio. I really want to say was another one. And so I think that's probably it right there.
So you're not a big fan of his late era WCW work?
No, horrible, horrible.
The Revolution?
Pure garbage.
Man, pure WCW garbage. Really raided ECW in that last couple of years, and just like it was just the worst possible timing because they were going away from that style due to Turner. They had to be a little bit more proper, and then this is when they have this big influx of guys who are best known for yelling and swearing. You know, it's like they didn't bring in the workers; they brought in the mic guys. You know, it was kind
of
like,
yeah,
all right.
I don't think they had any intention of using those guys properly. You know, the only guy I think that they did anything positive with was Lance Storm for a little bit. And I don't even like Lance Storm as a wrestler, but I think that he's the only one where I could say. Maybe they improved upon what he was doing in the other company.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably Storm's peak year. I'm going to throw another one out there. That was the year when he had all the titles. And they really, you know, screwed up on Mike Awesome, too, because he came in pretty hot, and then he's banging fat chicks and dressing like a 70s show. Red, whatever his name. Not Red. What's the guy's name? Eric's friend, the guy with the Hyde. Dressing like Hyde from...
Were you doing that 70s shows references?
Kelso. It was Kelso's peak year.
Kelso.
we'll cue the Ric Flair guys. Guys, whoa! Time is up, my friend. Sorry.
All right.
Hey, did you know that guy's sister died?
She was a big drug addict, right?
Yeah, man.
I mean, she was playing a 70s, you know, chick in her early 20s in the 70s, so it's not surprising that she OD'd.
I wonder if she's a Scientologist like the rest of them.
All right. It's an interesting crew. Who would have thought that, you know, Kelso and Jackie would find their way together eventually in real life? But I heard Eric was blocking Kelso banging Jackie, and then we could bring it all the way back to Triple H and Kurt Angle. He said, what kind of person would believe that Kelso would get a girl like Jackie and not Eric?
Oh, man, that's hilarious.
Okay, let's go to break.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and placetobenation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlacetoBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.com. Okay, we are back here, episode 7 of the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. I'm JT, along with Will and Dan McGinn. We have one challenge in the books where we played some fill-in-the-blank, and we're barely scratching the surface of that game, so that one will definitely be back in the future. That was a lot of fun. But we are here with challenge number 2, so Dan, please share with us your knowledge of this game.
Our second fall comes to us from a former great podcast, the Steve Corino Show. We're going to play a little good old-fashioned What If.
All right, so What If is one we've done before. Back in episode 1, we did What If Randy Savage had become stayed an active wrestler in 94 in the WWF and didn't leave or be relegated to an announcer role. So what we're going to do here tonight, we're going to talk about 1987, 86, 87 into 88. And Parv is going to jump out of bed because we're going to talk about his boy, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. And Will, what we're going to do is we're going to say, what if DiBiase had went to the NWA, Jim Crockett, instead of the WWF in 1987? So he does not become the Million Dollar Man. So we're going to take two paths on this. We're going to head down the NWA track and talk about what he would have done there. And then we're going to talk about the WWF, what they would have done with the Million Dollar Man gimmick. What would have happened with that gimmick? Would it still have existed? Would it have been someone else? And where would they have gone? Who would have filled his slot in a lot of those feuds, those top feuds in 88? So, but we will start the first half of the segment. We're going to talk NWA stuff. So, Will, why don't you get us started? Where do you see DiBiase heading when he signs up in very late 87?
All right. So let's give a little backstory here, just real quick. Prior to DiBiase going to the WWF, Bill Watts was losing money hand over fist in late 86, early 87. Okay. And eventually Crockett bought out Watts's UWF and what is now considered a stupid move in wrestling history, because they could have just let Bill Watts go out of business and paid nothing. Okay. DiBiase and Jim Duggan and Coco Ware and guys like that, they ended up in WWF with new gimmicks, whatever. Guys like Dr. Death, Steve Williams, the Freebirds, Eddie Gilbert, Sting, Ron Simmons, they ended up in the NWA. But I can't get over the idea that Ted DiBiase, who was widely considered in the industry you know, never mind what we see on tape, but in the industry, was considered one of the best wrestlers in the world at the time. Considered a great technical wrestler, great brawler, and that's there's evidence for that. He was an absolute great brawler. And so in 1987, you have Lex Luger joining the Four Horsemen. Ole's out. You have Nikita Koloff had just recently turned babyface to form the Superpowers with Dusty Rhodes. You had Barry Windham having classic matches with Ric Flair. And so what if Ted DiBiase joined the NWA when Watts went out of business instead of going to McMahon land and becoming the Million Dollar Man? So I think that's enough background. Would you agree, JR?
Yep, I think that sums it up beautifully.
Okay, so I'm more of a Southern NWA classic wrestling fan. That's just that's my house. That's stuff I enjoy. So I'm kind of foaming at the mouth of the idea of putting DiBiase in the NWA in 1987. Now, DiBiase was a face at the end of this run. So you can bring him in as a face.
Mm-hmm.
And automatically, and we have proof of this, you can have DiBiase go against Ric Flair and the Four Horsemen. He can come in to help Barry Windham, kind of be Barry Windham. Talk about dream tag teams. Barry Windham and Ted DiBiase, kind of at the peak. Are you kidding me? Okay. You can have him going up against, Ivan Koloff was kind of on his way out. But I think Dick Murdoch turned heel this year as well. So you could still have DiBiase and Murdoch, who have had classic matches in the past. You could have them feuding. You could have the Midnight Express beat him up. You know, Jim Cornette's Midnight Express early in the year was hot, and then Stan Lane joined Bobby Eaton later in the year. Could you imagine Ted DiBiase versus Bobby Eaton in a singles match in 1987? You know? So there are multiple paths that you can go with DiBiase, all right, in this year. So the first path I would want to go is Ric Flair. I think one of the biggest problems that the NWA had was keeping the belt on Ric Flair too long and keeping him a heel. Okay? Ric Flair, I don't care how good or bad of a wrestler Nikita Koloff is, Ric Flair should not have won at Starrcade 86. It was meant for a feel-good moment for Nikita Koloff to kind of raise his hand after Magnum TA's horrible accident.
Right.
And the fans never got that. Okay. Ron Garvin won the belt, but lost it that year. But Ric Flair was the heel. Okay. You bring in Ted DiBiase, somebody who's an established wrestler, somebody who we know can work face or heel. We talked about it when we did our draft, JR, for a few episodes. You bring him in as a face. I think Flair versus DiBiase in 1987 draws gates, and I think the NWA keeps – I mean, you could literally run the feud, whether you want them exchanging the belt or you want DiBiase fending off the Horsemen. You could run that for a good year, and it would affect future years as well that we can talk about in a minute. But what do you think about what's going on so far?
I like it. I like that take on it. I think your points on Flair are accurate. And, it's a feud we never really got to see on a big stage. So I think having them pair off over the title would be a big deal. I think that's a cool route to take it. If you look at DiBiase's arc, he's a guy that stayed pretty loyal. I mean, part of that may be because he has such a great gimmick. So I think we ride DiBiase out and we say he stays there until he hurts his back in 93. So where do we take him in the next couple of years? That's the question.
Well, okay. So if he's a world champion,
yep.
Right? We don't talk about DiBiase now as a what-if Hall of Famer, okay? Because he's a Hall of Famer, but it's always with question marks like, man, you know, what if he had actually won the world championship? You know, like it's always kind of an excuse to keep DiBiase out of the Hall of Fame. Well, he didn't really have the championship resume. we know that in WWF, unfortunately, because of who he was paired up, I know some people argue that the Savage matches are top flight, but they're not top flight compared to the stuff he was doing in Mid-South.
Yep.
And as a fan of NWA wrestling in the 80s, I'm just going to say it. The wrestling was so much better than what WWF was producing that besides Savage, there was nobody else that Ted could run with, where there are multiple guys in the NWA, depending on if you want them face or heel. I already talked about a couple of dream matches. Barry Windham, Ron Garvin, Bobby Eaton, Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, and Tully Blanchard. The list goes on and on. Like, it's not just a short list. Then if you need someone to carry a guy like Nikita Koloff, someone like DiBiase can do that. You know, you're also going to have Dr. Death in there. So you already have that tag team that the UWF had ran for the last year. Or you have DiBiase feud against Doc. You know, Sting's coming up. Sting really only had Ric Flair to kind of work with, to kind of put him over that the top. I mean, he had Barry Windham and those guys, but think if Sting would have learned under the Ted DiBiase and Ric Flair tree.
So let me ask you this. The ripple effect. We already know that Flair almost left in 88 when WWF came offering. Maybe he was going to have a feud with Savage, step into SummerSlam 88. Does he become more likely to maybe leave if he drops the title to DiBiase? Maybe he starts to see that his, you know, he's good. Dusty's still hanging around booking, so maybe he's starting to feel a little pushed out. Does he take that money? Does he jump ship? Does he leave WCW or NWA and go to WWF in summer 88?
Well, I think we have to look at what the business was doing, okay? You got to remember, Crockett was struggling in 88, right? So does Crockett struggle as much with Ted DiBiase? You know, because Vince is still going to probably do 93,000 for WrestleMania 3, right?
Yep.
Okay. But does he have the really hot angle to follow up with? You know, with the DiBiase buying the belt and the Million Dollar Man, and when we get to the WWF part of this, what if? You know, we'll be able to examine that, but. If DiBiase and Flair do hot numbers, to me, this is part of the problem with the NWA is the booking, right? So if DiBiase is there, does Dusty Rhodes kind of railroad him, you know, kind of make DiBiase Dusty's underling, you know, where DiBiase gets a feud hot only for Dusty to come in as the White Knight and the savior, like we talked about earlier. So there are a lot of factors. I don't know if DiBiase's the savior, but he's the only one I can think of like that if they would have picked up DiBiase in UWF sale. He's the only one that feels like he could instantly go to the main event of Crockett and everybody would be on board with it. Right? Wouldn't you agree? Because Doc wasn't ready for it.
Right.
You know,
Bubba.
But Big Bubba, Big Bubba was on his way out, right? Because he was really upset with the way the company was going.
Yep.
I'm just looking at guys, Sting, Eddie Gilbert. None of those guys were hot commodities. Terry Taylor, none of them. When the UWF went out of business, even DiBiase wasn't really like drawing well in UWF. But the Crockett crowd didn't have to know that, you know. The Crockett crowd would see, oh, Ted DiBiase, this guy's kind of a legend. And I think he would have really helped.
Yep, I would agree with that.
And so I don't know how far in 88 we could go. But, I mean, let's look at the WWF portion.
Okay.
And how that would change. And then we'll come back to the NWA. And I'll tell you how I would book DiBiase from, like, let's say 88 through 90, okay?
All right, so the WWF side...
If we have that much time.
Well, the WWF side, we have two questions. One is, what happens to all his feuds coming out of the gate, 88 into 89? And the second one is, what happens to the gimmick? Because we all know Vince had this gimmick in mind, and he wanted to do it himself, remember? It was a gimmick so great that he refused to tell DiBiase what it was until he had signed a deal to come into the company because he didn't want it to get out and have anyone else ever use it. So yep. You got to think he would have found somebody to use this gimmick at some point because he loved it so much. So DiBiase turns him down, says, no, I'm gonna stick at the NWA. Does Vince immediately find somebody else? Or...
I mean, he could have had the black hole of charisma, Mike Rotundo.
I was going to say Terry Taylor, the other black hole of charisma, who kind of maybe fits it, and he would be in later that year. But I don't know. I can't get off this idea that Flair gets pissed. He puts over DiBiase, and they start to phase him out. He gets frustrated with Dusty, leaves, because we know they offered it to him. And he comes in with maybe not the exact gimmick, but he's already kind of working it anyway. So does he come in as the, you know, as the Million Dollar Man proxy? Does he come in as a guy flaunting the money and buying his way? Does he buy immediately a title shot against Randy Savage at SummerSlam '88, and that's how they introduce him? Does he get the general gimmick that Ted DiBiase had received? You know, so maybe he's not the Million Dollar Man with the suit and the bodyguard and all that, but he gets what Vince was initially pitching, is a guy that uses his money, buys what he wants, and then does dastardly things. So maybe he... You know, maybe he's the one that gets the title off of Hogan by off of Savage rather than, you know, by buying a shot, because we got to assume he's not going to come in until at least the summer. So, right. I mean, that could change the whole trajectory elsewhere, though. Does Savage even win the title at Mania? Do they even take it off of Hogan? Because remember, originally they were going to put it on DiBiase in the tournament, and then Savage ends up winning the tournament.
Right, and there's no way that the Honky Tonk Man can say, I'm not going to put over Ric Flair.
Right. Well, no, Flair wouldn't be there yet.
Well, who do you have in the gimmick?
No, it's Flair, but they don't do the gimmick right away. So I'm saying we don't get because Flair probably wouldn't have come in. If we're going to be a little bit realistic, I don't think he comes in until the summer, because that's when he was already rumored to be talking, because he was going to come in for SummerSlam. So early in the year, I think maybe they don't even do all that stuff with Andre and the double refs, and maybe Hogan just retains in a match against somebody at WrestleMania and keeps the title until Flair comes in. So we may not even get the Savage Reign.
I got it now. Okay, I see what you're saying.
So maybe Flair comes in.
Or maybe they, do you think they accelerate the Savage face turn?
Right, so we might get that anyway, right? But without the title?
I don't know, man. I don't think the Savage face turn, because it's kind of like Hulk Hogan giving Savage his seal of approval at WrestleMania 4 that really solidified the face turn.
Right, so we still need a way.
Generated before that, kind of organically. But company-wise, it was the Hogan approval.
So do they find a way to do that without the buying of the title and all that stuff with DiBiase? Like, do they – I guess that's the interesting part to me. Do they immediately find somebody else to do the Million Dollar Man gimmick and the booking stays the same and someone just steps into that role? Or do we eliminate that character as is, as we know it, until maybe later on or not at all? Like, maybe Vince just shelves the idea until 2004 when he gives it to JBL, you know? I mean, does he – does he just put it in the basket for a while, or does he still use it?
You know, if a guy was 10 years younger, you know who'd have been perfect for that role? Nick Bockwinkel.
Right, yes. Yep, exactly.
If he was 10 years younger, you know, and I say 10 because, you know, if he was in his 40s, not his 50s, like, he would have been an amazing Million Dollar Man. Because he already had that arrogance and that kind of lifestyle in spades. And then you put the gimmick and the vignettes with Bockwinkel. Oh, give him Heenan or something. Oh, comedy. Just pure gold.
But so, I mean, I know he was pretty much done by 87, but could they have squeezed a year out of him in that gimmick?
It would have had the same, because you got to remember, man, this is something that's going to have legs.
Yeah.
15 guys.
Well, we don't know that for sure. We're assuming it will. But DiBiase could have spurned him, and Vince could have been so angry, and then they just bring Bockwinkel in, and it doesn't get the run it should have.
So let's see. So we're looking for the Million Dollar Man in 87, right?
Right, yep.
Who else in the wrestling world, because you brought up Terry Taylor. I mean, Ric Flair, if he leaves Crockett's an obvious one. Who else is there? Who else really could become the Million Dollar Man?
Yeah, besides Taylor and Flair.
Can't have Zbyszko because no one's going to buy that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a tough. That's why I'm thinking, do they shelve the gimmick? Does the gimmick just not even happen?
You know, because who's Vince going to trust? You can't have Bret Hart. He's too young. The Rockers are too young, too cocky, too... nobody else... it's almost like Ted DiBiase was destined to be that million-dollar man, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking through the roster at, like, WrestleMania 4. Yeah, no, I mean, no one jumps.
Greg Valentine, no. Ricky Steamboat, no.
Yeah, I mean, Jacques Rougeau, I don't know. I mean, there's really...
I'm thinking of the rosters of other companies, yep. too. You know, like somebody like from the AWA in that year. There's no way. Buddy Rose, give me a break.
Outback Jack.
Although Buddy Rose would be classic, but Buddy Rose with Virgil the man slave. I mean, that would have been comedy. That would have been good. But there's no way Vince would ever give that to Buddy Rose. You know who probably, but he was already disappearing around this time too, was Colonel De Beers, Ed Wiskowski.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been kind of like a good guy, because like Ed Wiskowski's really weird in that, like, when they give him gimmicks, he goes in full speed ahead. You know, like, he went in with that Colonel De Beers gimmick and did it to his best, even though he claims that, you know, it was all garbage, and you know, they has none of those South African apartheid thoughts. You know, that's not who he is. He still went in that gimmick, making you believe that's who he was.
Right, so here's a guy we didn't mention.
Who?
At least I don't think so. How about an AWA star that would eventually come in under a different gimmick, and that's Kurt Hennig.
Too young.
You think so? I mean, it was just not even half a year later they gave him Mr. Perfect. And that's another big gimmick.
Yeah, maybe, but Hennig. Here's the reason I don't think Vince would. Does Vince trust Hennig with that gimmick? DiBiase has kind of like, you know, 10 years of being right. like a top guy, whereas Hennig was just.
Well, don't forget we're operating in a world though where DiBiase is not the option. So do they have to give it to someone?
No, but I'm saying like.
Right, but are they forced to? Because we're running through all the other names, and no veterans are available. I mean, does he want to use his gimmick so badly that he's like, well, I really wanted it to be a veteran, but...
Well, what about the veteran that he had brought in, but brought him in as the king? How about Harley Race?
I see, he's kind of like Bockwinkle, though. I feel like he was... Well, I mean, he came in a year before anyway, so he would have already been around as the king for a while before DiBiase would have been born.
True.
In my mind, Hennig maybe had the gravitas to pull it off. I mean, we saw him pull off Mr. Perfect. Maybe we don't get the main event level stuff yet. Maybe they hold off a bit, but I think he could have pulled the gimmick off.
Yeah, him, you know, another guy too. It's too bad that they had already kind of made him their generic white meat baby face tag team guy was Rick Martel.
Right, yes.
Because Rick Martel had the looks to pull it off too.
You almost would have had it be like he won the lottery or was like bestowed... you know, like an endowment or something, and then he turns.
Yeah.
How about Tully Blanchard?
No way. Too ugly. Too hairy. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and I say that, like, Tully Blanchard was kind of going bald and just...
Well, you could pay for plugs now with all that money.
I don't see, like, Tully Blanchard, like, being a... I don't know. I would think it was credible.
Well, it's funny because the 80s, if you look at movies and TV, like that character is like a layup in every movie. Like they were always able to find the guy, you know, the smarmy guy with the slick back hair and this, you know, I'm thinking of like the guy like Major League, you know, that Rene Russo's dating.
I think Terry Taylor was a great heel in early 87. So
I think he's the guy too. I think it's him or Perfect. I think Taylor had the look with the slick back hair. I mean, we saw it later with the tailor-made man. I mean, he pretty much aped the look anyway. So he doesn't get it nearly as over though. So he may need a mouthpiece to go with him more than a bodyguard.
Maybe. But to be fair though, with Taylor, he was pretty great in his feud with Chris Adams in UWF in early 87. So, you know, maybe instead of having the Red Rooster, like Vince gave one of them the Red Rooster and one of them Mr. Perfect. Well, maybe they just give one Mr. Perfect and the other one.
I mean, Million Dollar Man.
Million Dollar Man, yeah. So that's possible. So if you have Taylor or Perfect as the Million Dollar Man, do you just continue the trajectory they're going on? And I do think Savage and Perfect probably have some pretty good matches in them too.
Yeah, I got to think those are the only two guys where they probably get that full. Like, I think it would mirror as close as we could with DiBiase, where you get that lengthy run because they both, well, Taylor did, but Perfect had it anyway. You know, if you bring in an older stopgap kind of guy, like you mentioned Bockwinkle or someone else, I think it just becomes a quick run on top, just like other guys they had brought in the past, Kamala and gang, like all these other guys that Hogan vanquished. Like, I think it would have been quick like that. I don't know if it becomes a long-lasting thing. I think Hennig is probably the closest we get to maybe sticking with the character and having a lengthy run.
I think you're right on that. I really do. I think the more I think about like Hennig and his heel run in AWA, he was so much better as a babyface, but he was cocky enough that I could see him being there. And then,
Rotundo too, though. I mean, that's
Rotundo's. Oh God! No.
I know, but just the look and being like he had it anyway. He had the sleazy '80s, '90s Wall Street money man look, and I think that's what they were maybe. I think they could have talked themselves into it because of how he would have looked in the gimmick. So I mean, obviously, it didn't have nearly the charisma of DiBiase, but that's why I think Hennig's the only guy that can match it.
I don't think that Vince would have the faith in Rotundo to pull that off,
right?
You know. Like, there's a reason he got the IRS. It's probably because Vince was pissed at the IRS, so he gives him, like, a shitty wrestler to be the IRS gimmick to vent his frustrations. Whereas this guy has to embody Vince McMahon.
Yeah.
And I don't think he'd have that kind of faith in Rotundo. But I don't know. So let's go back to booking, okay? DiBiase goes to the NWA 1987. The first thing... If I'm Crockett, is I'm putting him in a feud with Flair, okay? And I'm making if they're going to continue the Horsemen, I have DiBiase win the belt, okay? And I have him do it fairly quick too. I mean like Crockett Cup, all right? Like where Barry Windham got the shot at the title.
Yep.
I have Ted DiBiase win it like a couple of months after he's been there. And I have Ted DiBiase hold it until Starrcade. And so you don't have to do anything else with that except have Flair and DiBiase. And if it's successful, you just run with it. You know what I mean? And then you can have Dusty feuding with whoever he wants to feud with. Maybe have Nikita turn on Dusty, or, you know, the crowd was begging Dusty to turn heel anyway. They were already booing him, right? So then maybe have Dusty turn on Nikita. A little role reversal, something.
Right.
Okay. And then after you do the Flair feud in 1988, you can do Luger DiBiase. You can do Wyndham DiBiase. You know what I mean? Because Wyndham turned heel and Luger was heel like right around the beginning, you know. You can have DiBiase mentor Luger and say, hey, look, you had a bit of that lifestyle. Come roll with me. I'll show you the champion's lifestyle. And then maybe eventually have either DiBiase turn heel on Luger or Luger have turn heel on DiBiase. Doesn't matter. Either way, you just team them up and let them roll and fight off challengers until one turns on the other. Then you can have Luger as a hot feud because Luger was a really good wrestler in 87, 88, 89. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Then you could have if Flair's upset and hurt. Okay, cool.
Five minutes.
I mean, any thought to having DiBiase usurp the Horseman?
Take the Horseman away from Flair?
Yeah, he buys them.
Oh, dude, you know what? That's a great idea.
He buys them all.
I mean, I've thought about DiBiase joining the Horseman, but not actually. That's a great way to turn Ric Flair face, too, where Arn and Tully and these guys who have been with him for, you know, since 1985 – tell Ric Flair, no offense, but money talks. Turn on him, DiBiase, Tully, Arn, lay the boots to him, and whoever else is the fourth horseman, Wyndham, Luger, whoever they have, right? It doesn't matter, right? That fourth horseman slot is interchangeable. And just put the boots to Flair. Now Flair becomes a face again.
Yep.
Right? Because the crowd was already cheering Flair anyway. DiBiase steps into that heel role that he was so effective with in WWF anyway. And then you could do that, right? Where originally DiBiase is the face who wins the title, and now full circle, Flair's the face.
Yep,
I like it, man. That's a great idea.
And you could have it go a couple ways. Either he straight up buys them by offering them more money. Another way you could get a little complex too, and have it be like where they find out like Dylan and Blanchard had been siphoning Flair's money. Like Dylan had been saying he was running his, you know, his business, and he ended up basically Flair goes bankrupt or something like that. So now he can't even live that lifestyle.
Yeah, that's a classic Memphis angle, man.
You know, he can't live that lifestyle anymore that they're used to. DiBiase can, and then they find out that Dylan, you know, they find out that Dylan was the one, you know, taking the money from Flair and then giving it to him, and DiBiase were working together, something along those lines.
I like it. No, I think it would have made the NWA so fresh at the time. And then you can do mini feuds. You can do DiBiase versus Ron Garvin, who still had a lot left in the tank. You could do your DiBiase versus Sting, DiBiase versus Michael Hayes. You could bring some of those UWF feuds to light and Crockett. Plus, like I said, you don't have to stop there. You have the Rock and Roll Express, DiBiase, and the Fantastics later on. DiBiase abusing the Fantastics and the Rock and Roll. Oh, I'm so excited about what could have been. It kind of makes me sad.
So I think it's clear to say, because we got about a minute left here, I think it's clear to say the big loser is the WWF, and the big winner would be Crockett. I mean, I think that
easily.
That goes to say the quality of DiBiase, that there's no way, and we just exhausted, you know, both all rosters of 1987-88, and we can't even come up with anyone, you know, Hennig right. being the closest, that would maybe give you like 80% of what DiBiase brought to that character.
The only thing is that the WWF has an advantage with is, one, Hulk Hogan is still insanely popular at this
right.
time. But also Savage was legitimately become, like, Savage was a big star without DiBiase. So Savage is still going to be a big star, whether he's feuding with Perfect or Taylor or whoever you decide to put in that spot.
Right. You know? So we can say it won't hurt them, but if you're saying who's the winner or loser of the situation, they lose for not getting him. But I don't think it like ruins their business or anything. I don't think, you know, it takes away a lot of memorable moments and matches. We would have lost out as fans. They lose out of a memorable character, but I don't think it hurts them.
Right. Yeah, I think Savage was so entertaining at that time. And he was, man, we didn't even do a what if or a fill in the blank for Savage. Savage's peak WWF years were around this time, too.
Yep.
So Savage would have found a way to make it work. So Crockett still might have been in deep trouble. I don't know if DiBiase is a game changer. He's a game changer aesthetically, you know, in terms of match quality and keeping the traditional wrestling vibe that NWA had cultivated. But I don't know if he makes up for bad dusty booking and poor Crockett management, you know.
And I'm not sure I want to live in a world where Terry Taylor buys Sapphire away from Dusty Rhodes at SummerSlam 90.
Oh, man. Man, could you imagine then just like when Ricky Steamboat eventually comes in and,
yeah,
you know, just the Dangerous Alliance with DiBiase in the mix and,
yeah, a lot of great matches we never saw. I mean, you know, if you look at the matches we lose, I think it's more about the angles and feuds we lose in WWF versus the matches. Because, I mean, what great DiBiase matches do we lose? I mean, Savage, like we said, very, very good. Some of the stuff with Bret Hart. I mean, and otherwise, he had really hot feuds and good matches, but nothing like the match quality we probably get in
the
NWA.
Well, like the Jake the Snake feud was really disappointing in the ring.
Right.
You know, so that's
and he never had like top flight five. I mean, did he ever have like a, you know, even a close to a 5-star match in the WWF?
Never, not even close. His Savage matches were really fun. There were a couple of like really good ones, but nothing that came close to his like peak UWF Mid-South stuff.
Right. So you probably get more of those.
Guys, but your time is up.
Everybody's got a price again. How much to let us keep going?
The King Rat has struck again.
All right, yes, McGinn is a rat, you're right. So, all right, why don't we go ahead, we'll take a break, boys. Two in the books, we'll be back with challenge number three and some mail.
watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only place to be nation, Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, Lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, wrestling culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN, Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
Right, we are back here, episode number 7 of the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. We have two challenges in the books. We have played some fill in the blank. We have rebooked the life and times of Ted DiBiase. And that brings us to our final, our last, our grand finale, Bonanza Challenge, Will. And I had heard rumors that because it is SummerSlam week that we may have a little SummerSlam flavor. But I don't know if it's true. It might have just been, you know, the sheets just making shit up as always just to throw us off the scent. It could be, you know, something about AWA Super Clash for all we know. But Dan McGinn, why don't you tell us, what are we talking about for challenge number 3?
Gentlemen, your third and decisive fall, as brought to you by the devious minds of myself and Basil, we are going to present our SummerSlam memories. And I don't know about you two, but I can certainly feel the heat from up here in New England.
Yes, okay, very good. So, Will, the rumors were true out there on the internet. We are indeed talking SummerSlam memories with SummerSlam this weekend.
Yeah.
All right, so when I say SummerSlam, what is the first match or show that pops in your head? Boom. SummerSlam. What do you picture?
Man, I'm thinking CM Punk versus Brock Lesnar, man.
Wow.
Because after I watched it, I thought it was the best match in SummerSlam history. You know? And then Daniel Bryan and John Cena had a great match that kind of matched it the same night. But it really is. It really is. It really stood out as a special night. And I remember talking with people at the time, just so excited for that match, like Brock Lesnar and CM Punk. Like, a lot of people were very nervous that the match wouldn't come off well because, you know, well, there's no way that CM Punk can hang with Brock Lesnar,
right?
You know, just size difference, physique difference, whatever. But then I kept thinking, like, well, CM Punk told me point blank he was going to steal the show with Undertaker, and he did. And so I had faith in that match, but I also had a lot of faith in Daniel Bryan versus John Cena, and neither match disappointed. Well, okay, Daniel Bryan losing the title 4 seconds later to Randy Orton, that disappointed, but seriously,
that was a really exciting
time.
So that moment was interesting because it's a pretty memorable moment, like that audible gasp when Triple H walks behind him and pedigrees him. And if their original plan was for Bryan to have this long battle and then win at Mania, then you would say, okay, I see why they did it, and it set up a beautiful story. Unfortunately, that wasn't their plan. They ended up backing into it. But it's still,
exactly.
We still got it. But, I mean, if that had been their plan, I think it'd be a lot easier to swallow that loss to SummerSlam because it would have set up a great story.
Well, the problem was that they had like horrible booking for the next 3-4 months with the Randy Orton versus Daniel Bryan feud.
Right. Yep. I think what they were trying to do, we talked about Rock and Mick Foley earlier. I thought they were exactly trying to mirror that run that they had back in 99, where Foley was his beloved character. The fans were into him, and he really just existed to eat up The Rock's time heading into Mania when he had his real title match. And I feel like that's where they were headed. I feel like they were trying to just eat up time with his beloved underdog Daniel Bryan, and then he would be out of the picture before Mania, and Batista would come in and be the guy that takes the belt and runs with it. I feel like they were really trying to mirror that stretch.
No, you're right. That's exactly what they were doing. And, you know, that's shows the stupidity of the company and how tone deaf they were at the time. And I'm going to be honest, since we're talking about SummerSlam, I don't want to just make it about that one match, but I'm going to be a full disclosure here. You know, I've talked about it on this podcast before. You got to remember, I had stopped watching wrestling for like 6 years, seven years. Okay. Well, that's watching wrestling. I stopped watching WWF midway through 1987 after Steamboat lost the Honky Tonk Man and all those colorful neon characters started coming out. I really just was fed up. And so I didn't get back into wrestling until like NWO and Stone Cold and all that. My first SummerSlam that I remember seeing ever was 1997 SummerSlam. So I missed the first 9 years of SummerSlam. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because when I first think SummerSlam, I picture the old logo in my head and I picture Wembley Stadium, the big outdoor arena, Bret Hart, British Bull. Like that's what I think of when I first think SummerSlam. I also think of, you know, Warrior and Honky. I think of 89 with Zeus and Hogan.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of those early ones, and that's not to take away from the matchups we just talked about, because I'm with you. I think those are two of the greatest SummerSlam matches of all time. And as you know, read or will be reading on PlaceMediation.com, if you haven't checked it out yet, we did a top 40 SummerSlam matches, and those are all ones that are, you know, permeating the top of the list. So 97 is your first one, Will. Were you in before it? Like, did you get all the build up? Because I thought that was actually one of the best built SummerSlams in a long time to that point.
Oh yeah, man. I was full in at that time. By that time, I was all in. I had been following the entire Bret Hart, Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels saga. Now, I had no idea about any of the backstage stuff.
Right.
Like the Sunny Days comment and all that stuff didn't mean anything to me. It was just guys rattling off on TV, you know. But I was fully engaged. I was all in the month before Canadian Stampede. I was excited, man. I had actually been at the – I took my nephew to the Raw that summer where Stone Cold and the newly debuted Dude Love beat Owen and Bulldog for the vacant tag titles.
Awesome.
Yeah, so, no, I was all in at that time. Like, so, but I'm still more of a WCW guy, but the TV – and the main event was just so much better for WWF.
And when you look at the card they built, I mean, because, you know, they had been so flat, and even though the show was better in like 96 and stuff, they had still been flat, you know, product wise and overall the storyline wise. So 97 comes, they get red hot, and all of a sudden all these matches mean something. We have good angles behind them. We get, you know, Mankind, Triple H, and The Cage coming off their three match series and their feud that had established Foley as a face. Goldust, Pillman. A big feud going on with Marlena.
Yep.
That would eventually lead to, you know, Pillman has to wear the dress here because part of it was with all of the Hart Foundation matches had the stipulation attached. If you remember, so this one was Pillman had to wear a dress.
No, I think it was my Raw where the Hart Foundation came out and announced all of the stipulation matches.
Right.
Yeah. I think it was that Raw.
You get LOD Godwins playing off, you know, the Godwins' broken neck at the hands of LOD. So that was actually a pretty good feud throughout 97. Ends up being a pretty stiff, fun little match, too. Bulldog and Shamrock, part of the Hearts versus USA feud, the loser has to eat dog food.
Yes.
You know, whatever, gang wars. You get Austin, Owen Hart, of course, a red hot feud coming off a Canadian Stampede when Owen pinned Austin with the kiss my ass stipulation. And then Brett Taker, Brett loses, he'll never wrestle in the United States again. And
well, and Austin Hart, how did that change the course of wrestling history?
Right. With,
because that's to me, that's SummerSlam moment number two is Owen Hart breaking Austin's neck.
Right. So even beyond that, so just talking about the build, you know, and then Brett, you know, Brett Undertaker with the stip and Shawn Michaels coming back after his time off being the referee and coming out and, you know, obviously costing Undertaker the match and, you know, accidentally pace him with the chair that kicks off his heel run and the Hell in a Cell. Like, so much comes out of that match. But the build to it with Michaels cutting that awesome promo where he announces that he'll be the special guest referee and really, you know, amping up his issues with Brett. And then also the week before was one of the first times they did this. They did a SummerSlam Memories or SummerSlam kind of history show on USA.
Okay.
And they highlighted matches and moments. And in the ad for the show, they like talked about Hogan. Like, this is the first time they ever did something like that, really. They were like, you know, tune in next week. And it was like a quick hit promo. It's like Hulk Hogan, Randy Savage, Ted DiBiase, Andre the Giant, like naming all these guys that were going to appear on the special. And it was like a clip show, but it's something they hadn't really done before. And they used all guys that were in like WCW as part of the sell. And it was I thought it was really interesting at the time and it really added to the hype of the show.
You know what's funny too is that because around that time, like I said, I was fully invested in the product. They would show Yokozuna like falling off the the corner or whatever with the rope break, and I had no idea that that was the pre-match show.
Right.
You know, but at the time they played it up like this was a big SummerSlam moment.
Right. It was a 2-minute like, pre-show match.
Yeah, it was a 2-minute pre-show match, but it, you know, like the way they built it up on TV was like this big SummerSlam moment that you'll never forget, and I had no idea that it was just like a pre-show scrub match, you know.
So it's cool that they did that. They did it again for Survivor Series as well. And I remember just adding to the hype of this whole thing. And this is a big deal. It was the first show in New Jersey where they deregulated everything. Remember, they admitted that it was sports entertainment. And they actually had, like, was it the governor or someone was there? I think it was the governor, where she like names it WWE Day or whatever and welcomes back to the state.
Yeah, and then they showed all the fans outside and like if they were cheering for Undertaker or Brett and...
Yep, they did that a lot in 97, led to some...
Oh, that was so awesome. It was some of my favorite TV, man.
And then they also had the... this was the casket where the guy had to open the casket to get the $1 million or whatever. So a lot of fun stuff leading up to 97. You know, it's an interesting SummerSlam. One that may not have the best in-ring quality matches, but I can't even say that because the last two were very good. I mean, Austin Owen is really good until the finish, and Brett Taker is very good as well.
Just really long. It would have benefited if they cut off maybe 5 to 10 minutes of that. You know?
Yeah, I guess it'll be 20.
And you know, I'm doing my revisiting Dustin Rhodes, and I really enjoyed Goldust versus Jerry Lawler from '97. Mm-hmm. I wonder if maybe that Pillman match wasn't better than I expected because I remember like not really caring for the Val Venus feud when it happened,
right?
But loving it when I revisited the feud last year, like thinking, wow, this was actively a great feud, like in ring as well as all the shenanigans that were going on.
Yeah, and it was a great feud. I think the SummerSlam match is a little better, if I remember correctly, than the Ground Zero one. That's the one where Marlene has to go with Pillman for 30 days, but that led to all the XXX files and all the stuff with Pillman and Marlene in the hotel.
Well, I just want to watch the matches because Dustin always surprises me with great matches when they've been kind of universally panned, you know. So,
all right, so off of 97 for a bit. Any other, you know, kind of forgotten ones? I mean, you got 99, the one in Minnesota with Jesse Ventura. That was a cool moment where he came back for the first time. The company's red hot. You know, popularity wise, almost at the top, almost at their peak, as far as you know, mainstream acceptance and whatnot. Yeah, the kiss my ass match.
Right. Well, I want to talk about 99. Was horrible. Okay, and I remember thinking it was horrible when it happened.
The show or the year?
The show.
Okay.
Well, and the year. The year was pretty brutal up until Russo left. I want to talk about 2000 because we mentioned it earlier in the show.
Let's do it.
And I want to know what you think about these matches holding up or not holding up. The TLC, because that's another big SummerSlam, because they didn't call the WrestleMania match a TLC match, even though that's in effect
what it
was.
It was a ladder match, yep.
But I kind of like that WrestleMania match better than I like the TLC match, but the TLC match gets more love. So what's your take on the TLC?
Yeah, it's one. Maybe this explains it, is I don't remember a ton from it. Like, I remember the big bump off the ladders of the tables on the floor. And other than that, it doesn't, no spot really sticks out. Like, WrestleMania 16, I remember the table being across the ladders, and they were kind of teasing using it, and it was the first time Edge and Christian really ascended to win, you know, a really big match. And WrestleMania 17, I remember, because you have the Spike and Lita and Rhino all get involved. And I think that 17 is the one where he spears Jeff. Or is that 16? What's the one where Jeff is hanging from the belt and Edge spears him?
I don't know.
I think it's 16. Because then he does it again on
Raw. No, I thought that was the yeah, I remember the I remember that happening on TV.
Right. Okay, somebody else I think of. They did it on Raw. It was the night after Unforgiven 2000. I think it was the first Raw on TNN they did.
That's exactly it. It was the debut show on the new Nashville network.
But then I feel like they did it again at 17. I feel like they redid the spot.
You're probably right. You're probably right. But to me, those matches are matches that don't hold up for me. That's why I was curious if they held up for you.
Yeah, I'd have to revisit that one. I don't remember that one as well. So maybe I'd have to see it again. I haven't watched it in a while. The main event is interesting because, of course, you had the Angle stuff, which was really good heading in, and then he gets the concussion and he's out of it. That hurts the quality of that match. Rock and Triple H do their best to keep it together.
Yeah.
Benoit Jericho, I thought was very good. Probably not the best of their series that year. Blackman, Shane. Yeah, I mean, 2000 is an interesting show. It's good, but it's not as great as it probably could have been.
Right. Well, I don't know. I'm kind of glad Angle got knocked out. I kind of wish Triple H would have gotten knocked out instead. But I'm kind of in the camp that says triple threat matches are kind of passé.
Right.
You know, they do the same spots. One guy inexplicably gets knocked out for, you know, except in this case, he really did get knocked out forever. But for the most part, they use that as an excuse for just one guy to lay on the ground for 5 minutes. Then those guys will wrestle. Then another guy will lay out on the ground for 5 minutes. Then those two will wrestle. And so very few triple threat matches really excite me. I think one of the most innovative ones was the debut show for ROH, which was Christopher Daniels, American Dragon, and Loki. Mm-hmm. I think that's an awesome triple threat match. But in terms of SummerSlam, I mean, you had this one, which was a failure for what they were going for because of Angle's concussion. You had the 1999 one where Stone Cold was rumored to not want to put over Triple H, right? Which I think he dismissed on his podcast. But
I think it's been debunked. I thought the reasoning was they wanted Jesse didn't want to raise the hand of a heel.
Okay, but why not just have Stone Cold raise his hand that night and then have him put over Triple H the next night?
Yeah, maybe they didn't want him to lose to Triple H on Raw. Because, I mean, he put him over. He lost him at No Mercy.
Yeah.
15 minutes, guys. Later. 15.
But I don't know. So I'm not a fan of, like, the triple threat match in general.
Mm.
You know, there's exceptions to the rule. But to me, I'm just a little disappointed. But I don't know. I think maybe that can be a future watch on the network thing with the rest of the Place to Be Nation is rewatching the TLC.
Yeah, we could do that. Does it fit into our half hour parameter? How long was that match?
Oh, yeah, man. That match was like 15, 20 minutes.
14:51.
Yeah, we can probably even do intros too and celebrations.
We'll have to add that in. All right, so how about we fast forward a handful or so of years?
Well, what about you? Well, hold on. I gave you my memory. Well, what about you? Like, what really sticks out in your mind more than anything? Because you're just kind of going off of my.
Well, no, I did. I said Wembley, Bretton Bulldog. That's what I think of. Well, the one I wanted to talk about in a moment was one, and that's 2005. But we'll get to that in a second then. 91, I think of, with Boss Man and Mountie, where Mountie goes to jail. Always a memorable one in my mind, where Bret Hart wins the title over Mr. Perfect, kind of starts his ascension. 98 sticks out in my mind for the look. And even though WrestleMania 14 really started their comeback, and you have good shows after that, like King of the Ring and Over the Edge. To me, SummerSlam is like the official launch, pay-per-view wise, of their like super hot streak. Like, to me, that's their first major pay-per-view as a company that's back in business. And you can feel the atmosphere for the first time where, like, the crowd is just, like, out of control. And that look in Madison Square Garden that night was really cool, the way they had the set and the Highway to Hell, the build-up for that match was
out of control. Oh, yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome. And it felt awesome when I was watching it, too. Because, JR, at that time, I had not missed, okay? In fact, I didn't miss any WCW pay-per-views from 1998. And I had watched every single one since Sold Out Night. Put this, I watched every WCW pay-per-view from Sold Out 97 until Starrcade 98. And many of them I paid for.
Right.
Or, you know, we would do like parties and watch them. And for a while, a friend of mine had a black box and we'd go to his house like the next night and watch the pay-per-view the day before, or I'm sorry, like we'd watch the pay-per-view before Raw and Nitro started, you know? So we'd watch like, I don't know, 7 hours of wrestling in a day, you know? And I was a big WCW guy at the time. And WCW's pay-per-views started really dropping off, like embarrassingly so, in the summer of 98. And watching SummerSlam in 98 compared to Road Wild and Bash at the Beach and Fall Brawl, like these were really, really horrible shows.
Right.
And SummerSlam 98 just fired on all cylinders, whether it was angle wise, intensity, cool gimmicks that paid off, like the Lion's Den, seeing Jeff Jarrett get his hair shaved. Like, booking wise, it was a super smart show. And I just wasn't getting that with WCW. And I thought, wow, maybe I should focus on this WWF stuff. But then the WWF started getting really stupid. As Russo got more successful and more power, they started getting really stupid with their booking too. And I couldn't stand either company, you know. And it was the closest I'd come to just quitting watching wrestling again.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't, because we wouldn't be here today. So
we would not be here today. That's true.
Well, let's go ahead to 05. That's what I want to make sure we get in to talk about, because
okay. That
was Shawn Michaels versus Hulk Hogan. And so Hogan comes back in early 05 after being gone for a couple of years, after, you know, getting pissed with Vince, does the TNA stuff, tease anyway, Jeff Jarrett, comes back in 05. And out of nowhere, we get a tag match with him and Shawn Michaels against Hassan and Daivari. A Backlash kind of seems like a random team, Shawn and Hogan, but when you look at it, two legends, they play it up that way, and they have a loose relationship. And then all of a sudden in the summer, we get a tag match and they lose, or I forget if they win or lost, but and I feel like it was like the 4th of July show was around then, and Shawn turns on Hogan after the match, super kicks him out of nowhere, and then stands over him staring down at him, and Shawn dials back the clock to 97-ish and just goes full heel on Hogan leading up to SummerSlam. And it was glorious. I mean, it was like Shawn at his best promo-wise. He comes out. That's when he did the Bret Hart tease in Montreal when they play the music. And then he gets him again in the same promo. Remember, he plays it the second time, and they bite again. And then he laughs at him again.
That's right.
So, I mean, just a fantastic promo. He does the Larry King stuff with Hogan where he makes fun of him there. And then the match is so absurdly fun with Shawn just pinballing all around the ring like a nut. For Hogan, just going crazy. And old school Hogan, where he gets his ass kicked the whole match, hits the big bootleg drop and wins. It's so frustrating, but so fun to watch. And the next night, Shawn...
The next night,
Shawn like buries him in the promo, and then that's it. Then he's back to me in the face. It was so weird.
I think it was last year where like all the different people on the place to be got to watch a SummerSlam and like review a random SummerSlam. I requested this show and they told me I couldn't do this show. I was really pissed off. I don't know if it was you or Brad or Scott, but I was like, man, I can't believe they wouldn't let me do the show. Cause I had so much to say.
I'm going to blame Brad
back about that Brad I was about to drop another F bomb, but anyway, I was so upset that that Sean acted like he did. Like, that's when I felt all of this God and I'm a reformed Christian stuff was garbage, because he was so unprofessional in that match.
And I'm not gonna defend him, but it sounds like afterwards it came out that he thought he was gonna get a win back on Hogan. Hogan refused, and that's why he buried him the night after, and that he knew that heading into that match. But still, yeah, I mean, it's a farce and a spectacle, but to me, it's like so over the top that I enjoy watching it. Not because it's a great match, but because it's just a I'm counting that F-bomb. Just because it's a it's just a weird throwback with all the overselling and the way Hogan wrestles. But I really dug just the feud itself. I thought Sean was tremendous heading in. And then Hogan comes back the next year for the match with Orton that was not nearly as good. And, of course, the main crux of that feud was, remember they're supposed to have Davey Boy Smith Jr. and Brooke Hogan was all involved with Orton and all that shit. And it was supposed to start Smith as, like, supposed to get him off and running. As a top face, and that the only highlight of that feud to me was Orton RKOing Hogan on the car hood, but the match was nothing.
Well, don't get me wrong, I actually enjoyed the Hogan HBK match as spectacle.
I really did.
But at that time it was like, well, is Sean sincere? Is it a show? This is before you had like writers coming out on. Who's the guy who does TNA writing? Lagana. Remember when Lagana had his podcast and he would interview all the old writers?
Yep.
And like, and you hear it on like the MLW podcast as well, where guys will just say, look, I think that Sean is full of crap, that he's not sincere, that it's a work, that it's a gimmick, the whole God thing. And this is way before any of those shows confirmed it for me. I felt that he's full of crap. He's playing a part, because you just wouldn't act that way. So unprofessional and childish, if you were sincere in those kind of beliefs. And the problem was it didn't fit in with the storyline, like the shoot promo the night after.
Mm-hmm.
It had nothing to do with the storyline. Like, it completely went off any logical storytelling.
Yeah, that was all just him being.
That's when you knew it was complete garbage.
That's just all him. I mean, to me, that probably solidifies the rumors that Hogan had something had happened where he refused to do something. I mean, I don't know why else he would go out there and cut that promo. And then, because then Hogan's gone for a while. He again doesn't come back until 06 to do the SummerSlam match with Orton. And then when he started doing Hogan Knows Best and all that. So we talked about 13. I'm trying to think of any other more recent additions. They had the long stretch in LA. 09 was the Hardy Punk TLC match. 10, which you did talk about last year.
That was a great moment. Yeah.
10 was the Nexus stuff.
Man. Yeah, it's so disappointing.
2011 minutes, guys, 5 minutes.
Was when they ruined the CM Punk return.
Yes.
He should have been gone, and they did the world title tournament that should have been John Cena's heel turn, and then Kevin Nash returns.
I go back and forth on the Punk thing, though, because I get why Punk didn't want to. I mean, he said it, that he didn't want to miss SummerSlam because it was a big payday.
No. He knew. Dude, I talked to him that month, like in Vegas, like face-to-face, okay? And I don't care what people think. I want to tell the story, and Punk doesn't care. After the Money in the Bank thing, Punk would reach out to people, myself, Naylor, his friends, whoever, whatever, my buddy Lars, who I've done podcasts with, and talk about like what direction he should go. And I gave my opinions, and everybody gave him a different opinions. And one of the things I told him was, dude, don't fight Triple H, man. He'll kill the angle. I've always hated Triple H. And I saw him in Vegas, and he's like, and I hadn't watched Raw that week because, I was in Vegas, right? Vegas or Raw? Which one are you going to pick? I picked Vegas. And he's like, did you watch Raw? I was like, no. He's like, well, good. You're not going to like what went down. And he's like, I said, well, I heard about the pay-per-view match being set up. He's like, yeah, you're not going to like how that goes down either. You know? And so he knew it was dead. You know what I mean? He knew that the minute Nash and Triple H were positioned, it was dead. So he knew the writing was on the wall, but he just signed a big contract, had to play ball.
Right.
So he's like, okay, I lost this round. I'll win the next one. But he never won any rounds, you know? And that was the tragedy of the whole thing is that, you know, he was so invested in making that work. You know, and I've talked about this extensively on podcasts before, but he was so invested in making this work and really changing that. And honestly, if you look at it, one of my good friends pointed this out. This isn't me talking, okay? So I don't want anyone saying, oh, you're just stealing someone's words. One of my friends pointed this out to me, that really what Punk's vision of what WWE should be is coming to fruition now.
Right.
But who's taking all the credit for it? Who's getting all the props?
Triple H.
Exactly. You know what I mean? This is what Punk wanted 4 years ago. This is what Punk wanted. Bring in people who can work. Bring in people who can go in the ring. Bring in people that are fresh blood.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's what his vision was. It's what the pipe bomb promo was.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, you know, he would have preferred that guys like Cabana were up on the roster. He knew Hero could go. I'm sure he wanted Hero up on the roster. You know, I mean, but you know, guys that are there, he wanted these guys. He wanted the fresh blood. You know, all this stuff that John Cena talks about. Give me some fresh blood. Give me some guys I can go with. Right? Punk wanted that 4 or 5 years ago. You know.
So one thing I wanted to do, which we're not going to have time here today to do, and maybe it's a game for the future, is to compare SummerSlam and WrestleMania every year and say, you know, are there any years where SummerSlam was better than Mania? I mean, is there any? Because I feel like for a stretch, I think there were. I think SummerSlam was better than Mania for a stretch.
Probably 2000. Term. 2000, I would argue. You could argue SummerSlam was better than Mania.
Yep.
2009,
I think is. I know you don't like SummerSlam 99, but I think it's easily better than WrestleMania 15.
I don't think any matches on SummerSlam that year was better than Rock Austin.
Yeah. God, the rest of 15 is so.
Yeah, no, that's a bad show, but I enjoyed it more than like what WCW was putting on at the time, which is the tragedy. 98 is comparable, right? Like neither one of them has like that 5-star match or that really classic match, but the entire show was awesome. Like for both shows, right? The Tyson WrestleMania and the SummerSlam, the Highway to Hell that we talked about.
I'd go SummerSlam over Mania for that year.
But if you picked Mania, I wouldn't object to it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know which one I like better. Like, but I guess to me, that's a mood thing. 97 SummerSlam, maybe as a show, was better than the 97 Mania, except the 97 Mania had the classic I Quit with Austin.
WrestleMania 13 is one of the most unique cases. Right. We did that show earlier this year with Kevin Kelly and Steve Willey. We talked about that show, and it's a really unique one. In that match is so good, and the rest of the show is so bland and forgettable.
Yeah.
So that makes it real hard. But I mean, 95 to me is an easy one too. That where SummerSlam is better than
that's a good one. I would say 96, even with its shortcomings, you know, but HBK Vader, Undertaker, Mankind, probably better. I mean, I can't watch that Iron Man match. Like that's too much. I didn't even think it was a good match when I watched it originally.
Right. We're coming up to it in the Vintage Vault refresh, and I'm kind of dreading having to watch it again. But
it's easier if you're going to watch it with somebody. Like if you and I were on the line watching it, it's a lot easier to get through an hour long match that way. But watching it by yourself, man, that's like watching paint dry, bro. That's hard.
And we have no time for that, guys, because your time is up.
Oh. SummerSlam memories. Well, we're going to do that SummerSlam versus Mania thing in full one of these weeks. So, because to me, it's an interesting case study just to compare those shows because they're more similar than the other big ones, which is the Rumble and Survivor Series. To me, SummerSlam and Mania mirror each other a little bit more. So, all right, Dan McGinn, 3 challenges are in the books. Another show almost down. Why don't we do some mail, good sir?
We go to the party. We go to the game. We We ain't going to the disco. Ain't gonna cruise out, man. We're stealing people's mail. Stealing people's mail.
You've got mail.
Well, thanks, JT, and be sure to check out that SummerSlam 2005 rewind that I did with Scott Criscolo and Graham Cawthorn. It was from back in July of 2014. Check it out, PlaceToBeNation.com. But speaking of which...
You're such a jerk. You're such a jerk.
Seems like decades ago, Will, he was choosing your promotions over mine in the drafts, and now look at him, slapping you in the face.
Our first question comes from Michael Ingo Gutenberger. He writes, guys, what are your personal favorite feuds of all time, be it match-wise or storyline-wise?
Okay. Austin McMahon.
Hold on. I'm just impressed that Dan could pronounce that last name. Kudos to you, sir.
Steve Gutenberg. That's all I heard. I'd take Austin McMahon. I think it's up there as one of my favorite feuds of all time. Especially the initial iteration. And we talked, Will, a minute ago about how great 98 was during that stretch leading up to SummerSlam. And Austin McMahon was a big part of that. This revolutionary stuff that we hadn't really seen, especially with Vince being that character. I think Team Canada versus the U.S. in 97 is up there for me as well.
That's one of mine, too. Another one, and this is no surprise to longtime listeners to my shows, Lawler versus Dundee is easily up there.
Mega Powers.
Nah, they're just free to me. Freebirds versus Von Erichs is another one. NWO versus WCW in the early stages.
Yeah,
it got me back into wrestling. And of course, I'll agree with you. The Team Canada versus the U.S. stuff in '97, just great. Week to week episodic TV, just the kind of the peak of storytelling TV for that company.
Shawn Michaels, Chris Jericho in 08, really well done, led to some great matches. Rey Mysterio, Eddie Guerrero, didn't have the best payoff with the kid stuff in the ladder match, but
it was
up
fun.
To that point,
it was like a bad novella, so right. I was okay with it.
And the heel turn match was really good when Eddie beats the crap out of him, and then
for that feud, you know what the best part of that feud was? Was, and you can't find it on YouTube because I always search for it on YouTube, is Eddie did a promo.
Yep, I know exactly
where
which one
he's
going.
Behind the steel cage.
Yes.
And he's talking about how can you hurt a man who's lost everything,
mm-hmm.
and he's rubbing his nose up against the cage, and I get chills, especially now that he's gone. I get chills every single time I watch it, and I've been looking for it on YouTube, but it never pops up. Never. It's like one of those promos that like gets taken down or just somebody hasn't loaded it up yet. I get chills every time I watch it. One of Eddie Guerrero's best promos, and then that's after all the pay-per-view matches. That's right before the final cage match on SmackDown.
He also had that great promo too. The night, was it right around after the heel turn? Remember, he had Ray's mask and you're sitting in the chair in the ring.
Yep, that was awesome too. Oh, that's feud of the year for 2005 easily.
And then the beatdown at Judgment Day where he murders him with the chair coming through the ropes and then hits the brainbusters and all that stuff. So, yeah, a great feud, a really great feud throughout. And the whole thing was that Eddie couldn't beat Ray. Remember, that was the whole story, even though he had beat him in WCW. But
and they had the great feud in WCW in 97, eight years earlier. So, I mean, yeah, just Eddie Guerrero, one of my favorites of all time.
All right, Dan, what's next?
Our buddy Goodyear writes, in retrospect, did WCW use some of the talent that jumped to the WWF better than WWF did?
Well, who are we talking about?
The guys that jumped. I'm guessing Attitude Era type guys. One, I would say, we talked about in depth in episode one, I mean, Randy Savage. I wouldn't say on a whole they used him better than WWF, but they used him better than WWF had used him in his last few years. I mean, they reinvigorated
him completely.
That's absolutely
true. Yeah, that's a good one. You could say Chris Jericho got a boost from leaving. Eddie got a boost. Ray got a boost. Right? So
Hall and Nash are interesting ones. Because, I mean, they were used pretty well in WWF, but, I mean, WCW is where they became Hall of Famers. I mean, are they pretty much...
Yeah. But But at the same time, they really damaged the state of wrestling. You know what I mean?
Like, but at the time. I mean, at the time.
Yeah.
You know, that saved wrestling at the time.
Yeah, well, they got me back into wrestling.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, they saved it without a doubt.
That's a hard question to answer, Dan, without specifics, because it depends on who the wrestler is.
Right. I mean, I can think of guys that benefited the jump back to WWF. Like, I think X-Pac was used better than he was a six, even though he had some highlights of six.
Yep, yep.
Jeff Jarrett, who was used better in late 97. I mean, his second run in WCW was better, but his initial run in 96, 97.
Oh, it wasn't better. He was just pushed more. There's a big difference.
Right, well, that was the question, right? Dan, so it was who was used better?
But he wasn't used better because he should have never been in the main. Like, I would say WWF used him where he belonged.
Okay, I get what you're saying.
The lower mid card.
Right.
Whereas WCW made a huge mistake by making him a focal point of the show.
Right.
Really.
And his first WCW run was a mess with the wannabe horsemen and all that stuff. And his
he was a lower mid card guy. And so
They were almost putting him on Flair's level at times, though, with that feud.
Yeah, but that's more of abuse of Flair than it is of how they use Jarrett. You know what I mean? That's a Bischoff-Flair feud thing. But anyway, let's move on to the next question.
You guys, or at least Will, you alluded to a story earlier about CM Punk. El Bariqua wants to know, what is the weirdest or most unlikely place you've seen or run into a wrestler?
Does John Walters count? Because I had computer class with him, and that's kind of weird.
you know, let's go back to Bruiser Brody eating at Luby's with his family shortly before he died.
I guess an airport's not weird, but I ran into Big Show at like 7 in the morning in the Charlotte airport and bothered him for a picture. but airport's pretty standard. I don't know. I can't think of one. I feel like anytime I met a wrestler, it's at a place you would expect. It was like a bar.
Like, expect a wrestler, yeah. Like, I mean, yeah, just, you know, the only reason I was with Punk at that time is because we were both friends of Lars's, and we were both at the same show. Like, it just so happens that Punk was at that Rancid show the same time I had gone to go see Rancid, you know? So, it just, like, the stars converged on that. Maybe Chris Hero... spending the night at my house so we could watch Money in the Bank 2011. That's a good answer, right?
Yeah, I'd say that's weird that he's in your
house. Well, no, because, I mean, Hero was my friend before, you know, he went to ROH or, you know, any of these places, right? Like, you know, just because Hero's an internet nerd, okay? And, you know, you get into the tape trading game, you know, you hear from people. And that night... Hero had said, "Hey man, I'm going to be wrestling in Austin. Why don't you come up and see me?" I'm like, "Dude, I'm sorry. I am invested in this Money in the Bank thing." And he's like, "Oh, don't worry about it, man. I'll find someone up here, one of the workers up here to tape it, and we'll just watch it at their house after the show. Just come on up." I'm like, "Okay, cool." But I didn't trust him, right? I really didn't. I was like, "Man, if I miss this, I'm going to be really upset, right?" And so I bought the pay-per-view and recorded it anyway. And my wife and I went up to Austin, and we were waiting for him after the show. And I was like, "All right, man, so whose house are we going to?" He's like, "Dude, nobody had it." And I was like, "Oh, thank God." I was like, "Man, I knew something was going to happen." I said, "That's why I recorded it." And his eyes lit up. He's like, "You recorded it?" He's like, "Yeah." So he's like, "Hold on." So he comes back 15 minutes later. 10 minutes later, he's like, "Hey man, if I get somebody to pick me up, you know, because he was based out of Austin.
Yeah,
if I had someone come from Austin pick me up, can I hang out at your house tonight and watch the pay-per-view?" So we drove back 90 minutes to my house to go watch the pay-per-view at 2-3 in the morning. Finished watching it at 6 in the morning, and spoiler free, we both stayed off the internet long enough to watch it. And so that's probably the most unique experience.
Yeah, I don't think we're gonna top that one. That show's always funny. It's got funny lineage here with the Place to Be podcast and Place to Be Nation, because during 2011 Scott and I were doing weekly headline shows, and throughout all of 11 after Mania till that point, I mean, we're just slogging through these shows, right? Through headlines, and Raw was just kind of blah and all this stuff. And Scott was going on a cruise, and it kind of became a long-running storyline. We're joking about the cruise. He goes on the cruise, and he misses Money in the Bank, misses the pipe bomb the week before, misses Triple H coming out and doing. So it's like every, you know, he was around for all the crap. We had to record weekly talking about all, you know, our truths push and all this other stuff. And then he goes away, and it's like the biggest night in wrestling history in how many years. Goes down, and we couldn't even do a freaking show because he's away in, you know, Bermuda somewhere on a boat. And it's like, oh my god, the one time we could have jumped on right away and like done this massive show after the pipe bomb and leading into Money in the Bank, and he's out sailing the seas and, you know, has no clue what's going on in the world of wrestling. It's like massive story.
Somewhere on the internet, there's a show with me, Rob Naylor, and Lars talking about the pipe bomb promo for like an hour and a half after it happened. So this was before Naylor went to WWE to NXT. So
maybe we'll just make that a Dangerous Alliance episode and not tell anyone. We'll just air it.
There you go. There you go.
All right, Dan, we got time for one more, or is that 10?
I think we have time for one more. Okay. Although I think meeting Michael Bennett while he was walking Maria's three little dogs was pretty funny.
You know, Kevin Kelly sucked down wings. Yes.
This big jacked guy and these three little rat dogs walking around like some random neighborhood in Connecticut.
That's awesome.
You know what? When you're married to Maria, you'll do whatever you got to do.
No kidding. Guys, our friend Parv brings us a gem once again. Guys, Ted DiBiase has a well-kept beard. Who has the most well-kept beard in professional wrestling?
Jim the Anvil Neidhart.
Hillbilly Jim.
Yeah, Hillbilly's is, die or not. It's held up very well over the years.
It's very, and now he's keeping it trim and clean, and he, like Hillbilly Jim as a wrestler, no, it was very unkept beard. But now, you know, it's very, like you said, it's very dyed, it's very trim, it's clean. And you know what? I didn't bring him up because he I saw him at Access, which is where you expect to see wrestlers.
Mm-hmm.
But by far, like, the nicest guy I met at Access that weekend, except for Norman Smiley.
Yeah, he'll be super nice. Scott and I met him, too, during the WrestleMania 21 road tour or whatever in Connecticut. Yeah. Really nice guy. But, you know, one beard that it's not a full beard. Scott Hall's ability to always maintain that 5 o'clock shadow always impressed me. It was never changed.
There you go.
It was always the same. And that's not easy to do, to maintain that level of stubble at all times.
Got to throw a beard in from the 80s. Michael P.S. Hayes.
Yeah, he had a quality beard. Shawn Michaels always had a lame beard when he did the stubble. And I guess he's back at it now. You hate Triple H, but what about his Motorhead tribute, Lemmy tribute, when he had the...
It's horrible. Of all the wrestlers to do Motorhead tributes, you know.
Boys.
Oh, God, it's disgusting.
I was going to say, you're just trying to get another F-bomb out of Will before we go off the air, aren't you?
He is. It's not going to happen.
Well, we talked about Triple H's beard, and we talked about Triple H's beard, Scott Costolo. So I think we're good with mail for this week, Dan McGinn. So why don't we go ahead and wrap things up. Episode 7 is in the books. It's been another great installment, as always.
Yeah, make sure you listen to Goodwill Wrestling SummerSlam week this week. So many great shows.
Yes, tons of shows for you to enjoy and listen to. You can relive last year's SummerSlam Rewinds, as we talked about. Place to Be podcast, Kevin Kelly, Main Event, all coming at you each and every week. Tons of podcast content, Exile on Bad Street, Between the Sheets, one of my new favorite shows as well. Be sure to check that one out, too. So, for the crew, for Will and Dan, I'm JT. We will talk to you in 2 weeks' time. Everyone enjoy SummerSlam, and we'll catch you on the other side.